Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, September 27th, 2012. Hey, Iraq, we're back. American troops have returned to Iraq.
You thought Saddam had WMDs, gas and bombs and what you please. Now you find this global threat you sold is just a little rat in a stinking little hole. I want you to tell Mom all about it. Tell Mom what you need.
Well, item one, an Edie in Atlanta, one of our loyal listeners, caught this too. On the Rachel Maddow Show last evening, Wednesday night, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader of the House of Representatives and the would-be future and definitely former Speaker of the House, told Rachel that she will never forgive George W. Bush for sending American troops into Iraq under false pretenses. But gosh, Nancy, you already did. You took impeachment off the table in 2006, 2007, 2008. And then we got Obama, who looks forward, not backward, so no accountability whatsoever has been provided for those misdeeds. And I mentioned yesterday that Senator Feinstein, Democrat from California, told the San Francisco Chronicle how much she regrets her vote supporting Bush's foray into Iraq. And against that backdrop, remember this from President Obama?
We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan.
That was from his inaugural address in 2009. And we learn now, buried deep, deep, deep in the 15th paragraph in a story in Tuesday's New York Times that is nominally about the spillover of the war in Syria to its neighbors, and it focuses on Iraq in particular. And the story is largely based on conversations with Lieutenant General Robert L. Caslin, Jr., the American commander in charge of supplying weapons to Iraq, since we left, right? We left. Didn't you hear at the convention that Obama ended the war in Iraq? Now, that's quite an overstatement because the civil war there continues. But we have been led to believe that all American troops have left the nation of Iraq. And as I mentioned in paragraph 15 of this story, it tells us that at the request of the Iraqi government, according to General Caslin, a unit of Army Special Operations soldiers was recently deployed to Iraq to advise on counterterrorism and help with intelligence. And reportedly, there are requests for more American troops going into Iraq. Now, it was just over the weekend that the same newspaper, the New York Times, ran an interesting story that went into some depth about the final year of the U.S. occupation in Iraq, about the mad dash on the part of Obama administration officials to get the Maliki government first to share power with the CIA goon Ayad Alawi, who Bush tried to thrust on the Iraqis back when, 2005, 2006, in that range. And the haggling over efforts to keep 25,000 and then 15,000 and then, okay, 10,000 American troops on the ground in Iraq, even after the expiration of the Status of Forces Agreement at the end of 2011 that called for all American forces to leave. And so this is an example of what in journalism school is called burying the lead. The lead is that American forces are back on the ground in Iraq. We don't know how many special forces were deployed. A unit of soldiers. That is a nondescript term that doesn't tell us how many. And we certainly don't know how long they expect to be there. This is important news. It certainly bears debate in the presidential campaign. It bears debate in the Senate and House races this fall. Will it come up in the first debate next week between Romney and Obama? Well, that's up to the media. And if we leave it up to them, the answer is likely, nah. Doesn't have enough gotcha potential. Well, maybe it does. But of course, Mitt Romney deplored the withdrawal of American forces, so he doesn't have much of a leg to stand on to oppose anything that Obama has done. But clearly, the president should be held accountable, and the American people should be notified that we've got boots on the ground in Iraq once again. Meanwhile, as part of the Romney campaign, the Prime Minister of Israel spoke to the UN General Assembly here on Thursday. Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to be channeling Colin Powell. He didn't use a PowerPoint. He didn't pull out a vial. Instead, he had a cartoon. A diagram of a cartoonish-looking bomb with a fuse to show the Israeli view of Iran's progress toward making a nuclear weapon. And this is Netanyahu's call for a red line, trying to drag the United States into a preemptive strike against Iran, which would be sheer lunacy. As I referred yesterday to the Senator Feinstein interview, she said they're enriching uranium at more than 24 locations. And no one is less pro-Israel and more hawkish, in my view, at least in the Democratic caucus, than Senator Feinstein. And so Netanyahu pulls out a diagram and tries to use it to illustrate his extremely belligerent point of view, which is undermined by this news from Jerusalem. The Israeli Foreign Ministry is calling for more sanctions on Iran. What does that mean? Well, on the one hand, Netanyahu says that the sanctions aren't enough. They haven't produced a behavioral change on the part of Iranians. And therefore, we must attack, attack, attack. And yet his own foreign ministry confirmed in what is characterized by the New York Times as a rare Israeli acknowledgement that there might still be time to try to stop the Iranian nuclear program by means other than military action. And none of this corporate media reporting acknowledges what we've told you and what Gareth Porter has revealed, that the Iranian negotiator at the recent conference in Istanbul said that they would suspend enrichment at the 20% level, which is uranium that could power a nuclear power plant but not enough for a bomb, if the West would lift the sanctions. And so we have another Iraq on our hands here, where information is being controlled, manipulated, withheld, in promotion of a particular outcome. The sanctions have already hammered Iran, a 50% decline in its oil exports this year, representing a $40 billion loss in oil revenues to that country. And we can't have it all ways here. We can't maintain that they are an existential threat on one hand, and we must attack immediately, but on the other hand, let's ratchet up the sanctions. And then ignoring this overture from Iran that may or may not be substantive, but is certainly worth pursuing. I mean, that's the bottom line to me. Violence on the streets of Athens as citizens push back on the next round of austerity. And on the PBS NewsHour last night, the report from Athens included a government leader who said, "We promise this is the last round of cuts in wages, of cuts in public employment." Now, if you were a Greek, would you believe that? Somewhere in the range of 25% of the people have lost their jobs in the last year or year and a half alone. And the idea that they can handle more austerity and have their economy controlled by essentially the Germans in exchange for bailouts from the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank. I am just dubious that this will work. Meanwhile, in Spain, another round of austerity has been announced, and that government, too, is angling for bailout funds in exchange. And, you know, it's easy from here to say that the Greek and Spanish governments are responsible for their own economic failures, for bloated public employment, for expansive social welfare benefits. It's easy to do that. But the pain that people are feeling, these drastic and dramatic changes over a very short period of time, is real. There's only so much people can take. But there don't appear to be anybody with feelings at the IMF and these other international financial institutions. Well, the neocons are back. And this is a very interesting op-ed in Thursday's New York Times, co-authored by Michael Doran of the Brookings Institute and Max Boot, a well-known neocon from the Council on Foreign Relations, and he is billed as an advisor to the Romney campaign. And these guys are shameless and truly disingenuous because they offer five reasons why the U.S. should intervene in Syria now. And it's clearly just a political provocation aimed at giving ammunition to Mitt Romney as he tries to attack the president on foreign policy issues. And as you know, I don't agree with the president on a lot of foreign policy issues. But Mitt Romney is a guy who is a chicken hawk of the highest degree, has surrounded himself with these neocons who want to continue the PNAC plan to just bulldoze governments in the Middle East and install regimes more friendly to the United States. So these five reasons to intervene in Syria now are framed around what they consider to be the Obama doctrine: getting into a conflict zone and getting out fast without ground wars or extended occupations. And they compliment the president for, they say, this approach proved its effectiveness in Libya last year. And they want him to apply it to Syria. And Syria and its Iranian allies and its more distant allies, China and Russia, this presents a very different picture than Libya. And the fact that these gentlemen who know better, I mean, Max Boot is dangerous, but he's not stupid. And so these neocons trot out these arguments about how American intervention would diminish Iran's influence in the Arab world. Not likely. A more muscular American policy could keep the conflict from spreading. Not likely. This idea promoted by Romney that America can project fear and that the Arab street will knuckle under is just pure fantasy. Third item, by training and equipping reliable partners within Syria's internal opposition, we can create a bulwark against Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is on the same side with us in Syria. And it's not easy to predict from here whether the array of forces, including the so-called Free Syrian Army, that are opposing the Assad regime, we have no idea how it will play out in the end and whom they will align with. And so these are pipe dreams promoted by the neocons, but the true agenda here is to try to give Mitt Romney a wedge that he can use on foreign policy against Obama. It's really irresponsible to take these hot wars and inject them into the American political campaign here for president this year. It really is remarkably risky, and these people seem to know no limits. Here's another page from the neocon Bible. It's about torture. And Charlie Savage, who is one of the reporters I respect at the New York Times, wrote an interesting piece, and it's based on advisors' commentary and documents that have been given to Mitt Romney, saying that he wants to rescind and replace President Obama's executive order, which bans torture. Now, I don't even know if Obama's ban has been completely enforced. We don't know what's been going on at the Parwan prison at the Bagram Air Base, where we don't even know who's being held there. So, it's an open question to me, but as a policy matter, I embrace the president's executive order, and Romney wants to lift it. Romney, at a news conference last December in Charleston, South Carolina, said, "We'll use enhanced interrogation techniques, which go beyond those that are in the military handbook right now." And when pressed about whether Mitt Romney believes that waterboarding is torture, he says he doesn't believe it is. It's just enhanced interrogation. The policy paper acknowledges that it is hard to know what would be different had Bush's interrogation policy continued, but it argues that Obama's approach has hampered or will hamper the fight against terrorism by forbidding techniques that we should feel as a nation that we have a right to use against our enemies. This is mind-boggling. We have no right to use torture against our enemies. We have simply asserted it and ignored our treaty obligations and the world community. And we're paying for it. As I've pointed out, it's one of the reasons why there are protests in Arab cities around the world and in Muslim capitals around the world. Here in the United States, the battle over who's to blame for the economic meltdown led by Wall Street and the bailouts that followed is being stoked by Sheila Bair. She's a Republican, formerly head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and she's pissed at Tim Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary and the former New York Federal Reserve Chairman. Bair paints Geithner as an apologist for Wall Street, who opposed post-crisis reforms. She questioned whether his effort to inject billions of dollars into nine big banks masked a rescue intended solely for Citigroup. Her new book it's got a lengthy title, Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. And as I mentioned, Sheila Bair is a Republican. But she has spoken the truth about what was going on. She was excluded from many of the major decisions, and she blames sexism for some of that. Maybe the boys didn't want Sheila Bair playing in their sandbox, she's quoted as saying. I'll be looking for that book and see if we can line up an interview with Sheila Bair down the road a little bit. Senate Democrats have written a letter to the Interior Department to halt the Alaska offshore drilling in the Chukchi Sea. I finally figured out how to say that, Chukchi. Barbara Boxer, Dick Durbin of Illinois, Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, Patrick Leahy, Vermont, Jeff Merkley, Oregon, Sheldon Whitehouse, Rhode Island. They questioned the oil spill response capabilities in the Arctic, say there needs to be better scientific monitoring plan, and they want more areas off limits. Well, that's a start. That is certainly a start. Investigative reporter Steve Horn tipped me off to his latest post at dsmogblog.com, which takes a look at the state-level regulation or failure to regulate oil and gas wells and the related facilities. And this is based on a report published by Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. And you know how we hear about how regulations are the problem and that it's, choking the economy. These are job killer regulations. Well, what it points out here is that enforcement on the oil and gas extraction industries is almost non-existent. The shocking findings that 51 to 90% of the active wells studied in six states, Colorado, New Mexico, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas, have operated with zero inspections since the beginning of the recent boom in shale oil and fracking gas going back to 2008. Over half of all wells go uninspected each year in these six states. Hundreds of thousands of active oil and gas wells across the country are never inspected. And I encourage you to read this. I'll put up a link to DSmog blog in the show file at peterbcollins.com. In Wichita, Kansas, it may be possible soon to get an abortion. It's been 3 years since Dr. George Tiller was killed by a raving Christian lunatic. And a group called Trust Women Foundation has purchased Dr. Tiller's clinic site and hopes to reopen it shortly. And as we pointed out, there are now five states where abortions are not illegal, they're just completely unavailable. And Kansas is one of those, and if this clinic reopens in Wichita, it'll be an important step in the right direction. At UC Davis last November, you've probably seen the video, students who were occupying the campus and protesting, who were sitting and locked arms, and the campus cops spun it that by locking their arms, they were preventing the movement of the campus cops. And you've seen the video of a guy named Lieutenant John Pike, who was spraying them like he was, spraying kids who were too hot in the summertime, or spraying, you know, cotton candy or whipped cream on people. But it was a very virulent form of pepper spray. And it's interesting because the University of California has agreed to pay each of the students who were victims of this police riot $30,000. And they're doing this without having to go through a whole legal process. It's to preempt court proceedings. Now, to be fair, they've already exonerated the lieutenant, although he did resign from the campus police force. And they have argued that this was a legitimate use and complied with the University of California policies. So the $1 million that this will cost comes from the university's General Liability Risk Program, a self-insurance fund, $630,000 for the students, $100,000 from others who can prove that they were sprayed during the incident, and $250,000 to the ACLU, which represented the students. And finally today, you know that the thing that I have been covering most passionately here is the indefinite detention clause of the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021 of that bill. And I just learned today from the Huffington Post that a progressive PAC, a political action committee called Demand Progress, has just released a Facebook app that allows users to spread the word about indefinite detention by putting their friends or the profile pictures of their friends behind bars. And doing this shares a link containing more information on the measure, as well as a digital petition form to send to Congress. If I'm able to, I'll put a link up to this, and I'm going to try it out over this coming weekend. I'll see if I can download this Facebook app and put some of my friends behind bars. It seems to be a very interesting and colorful way to get people to sit up and pay attention to the draconian law that President Obama's lawyers have defended, even after a courageous judge imposed a permanent injunction on its enforcement. Thanks for dropping by today. Please share this podcast far and wide. It's free, and I hope you'll spread the word. Much obliged.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.